Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 114 for August 11, 2011, In Search of Studio X. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Thanks for joining us, folks, and thank you for being here, Mr. Auto Extremist.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you again.
I feel so much better when you show up every Thursday night.
I got to do the show for you tomorrow, right?
You do. Yeah, I got some work early in the morning, so you'll be filling in for Autoline Daily. Thank you.
Yes.
I'll thank you in advance.
Glad to do it.
Well, look, we don't want to talk about the stupid markets and the meltdown in the world. Who cares about that?
No, we can't. I can't bear one more word about it.
So let's not talk about that.
The hand-wringing.
I know.
Let's talk about Lincoln.
Let's talk about Lincoln, because I got to go in there this week, and they showed me a bunch of stuff. And I know you're very familiar with it, too.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, man, but I was really impressed.
Yeah, you know, people keep asking me, well, what's Lincoln doing? What's Lincoln doing? And they're not going to make it. And then you see the stuff, and you go, oh, okay, I get it. The new MKZ is sensational.
Sensational. I agree totally.
Yeah, it's got a real
showstopper.
Yeah, it is.
And I think they'll be showing that probably, what, Detroit or New York?
I don't know. Not Detroit, because I think they're probably going to unveil the Fusion before they do that. That's a whole other story. when you see what they're doing, and it's not just the cars. It's the plan. It's the strategy. It's the dealers. It's everything. They are giving it what the brand deserves. And, you know, they know it. It's been neglected for a long time. And, you know, they've lived on the black cars, the metro cars to the airport. And, you know, they're asking a lot of their dealers. You know, it's the dealers didn't see the car till June, this past June.
Uh-huh.
And
they're getting rid of bunches of dealers.
Well,
have
gotten
rid of bunches of them.
Yeah, and the ones that stay have to spend. And I don't think people are quite prepared for the transformation of Lincoln. It's going to be very impressive.
Well, the thing I was very much impressed by was they're creating a Lincoln organization, because in recent times, they've run Lincoln on a matrix organization. So if I'm a designer, an engineer, even a marketing person, I'm called in on an as-needed basis. I do my little bit, and then I go back to the mothership, and I work on blue oval stuff.
Yeah.
And so nobody was really in charge of Lincoln. No one was running it, and it really showed. And now they're creating a core organization of executives, and this is the thing that I emphasize, with international experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting, the team they're putting together. And Lincoln's just been given its own design studio, its own design staff. We'll have to talk with our guest, because we should tell everybody we got Ed Welburn coming in later in the show, because they stole one of his guys away, Max Wolf, who's now running the Lincoln design team. But to me, that is the core of it. And I'd love to see them go all the way, because, you know, up through the 1950s, Lincoln was run as a true house. It had its own headquarters, its own designers and engineers. It had its own assembly plant. And I'd love to see it go back to that. But I better not get too excited. I don't think they're going quite that way. Nonetheless, this new organization, I think, is going to really pay off for them.
Yeah, it's going to pay off, and where the rubber meets the road, these new Lincolns coming are definitely visually arresting on the road. It'll be good to see that brand back.
Well, my question, too, all along was, how can they possibly take Ford platforms and make Lincolns out of them. And the thing that I was impressed was they are going to use corporate platforms. However, you know, as I've pointed out before, platform sharing starts to break down when you have top management that tries to take cost saving too far. So you have to use common body side apertures. You have to use common doors. You have to use the whole greenhouse structure. So even if the headlamps and the tail lamps and the ornamentation's different, the silhouette's the same, and people see through that, especially if you're going after a discerning luxury buyer.
Yeah.
They see right through that. And that's what I was very encouraged to see is they're going to spend real money on hard tooling to really do differentiation. So the entire greenhouse is going to be different.
Yeah, it's exciting to see. And I think especially our listeners and viewers out there, you know, be patient because it's going to be worth the wait.
Yeah, the first car you'll see is the MKS. And they've done a nice refresh. When you see the MKS, which will, I think, probably be at the LA show, don't judge what we're saying by that car.
Yeah, no.
It's not indicative of the new change that's coming. The MKZ definitely is.
Yeah, MKZ is the first one that really will tell you what Lincoln's going to be about.
And, you know, you raised the dealer issue because that is a significant weak spot in the brand right now.
Yeah.
And their goal is to pare the number of dealers in the U.S. down to about 325, which, as it turns out, is the same number that Mercedes-Benz has in the U.S. market. And they showed me some concept drawings of what these dealerships will look like on the inside. And it's kind of like going into an upscale boutique hotel. You know, they've got a nice design theme to them. And the dealers are going to have to spend some money to bring it up to code, so to speak. But it's what they've got to do if they really want to sell to buyers who might otherwise consider Lexus or BMW, Audi or whatever.
I'm driving the A7.
You like that car, don't you?
Yeah, well, we've talked about it. I like the A8 like you do.
And I've had the new A6, and I like that a lot. And maybe I'm just too much of a contrarian. Everyone seems to be so in love with the 7 that I'll say the 6 is better. But
well, to me, yeah. Yeah, 8, 6, 7. You know, Audi is, you know, I think the 7 right now is the state of the automotive art, you know. Inside and out, nose to tail. It's, you know, they get it and they're on a roll and they haven't made a misstep lately in a long while. So the 6 is cool. I'm with you. The 8 is...
Well, the 8 is just such a substantial car. It really is. And in some respects, it can feel a little heavy, especially compared to the A7. But you know you're really in a luxury car in the A8.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm driving a little Fiat 500, which I like right now. But you don't seem to be convinced that... this thing's going to hit the target.
Well, I mean, okay, I'm of Italian heritage. I'd love to see them succeed. I love the 500 in context. When you're in Europe and you see them, it's like, wow, it's cool. But over here, I'm afraid that this car, it's not substantive like the Mini. I don't care how many versions they do of it. I just don't think it's there. So I think we're talking about once the first on the block people get them, and that's anywhere from 12 to 24 months. They have a window, and if they don't have it then where they're cranking them out and selling them every year to a certain amount, it'll be nothing but a minute player in the market.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how sales go. Last month, they sold 3,000 in the U.S. market.
Well, that's definitely the first on the block, people.
And that's, yeah. And if they can maintain that, that's pretty good for them. But I'm not sure they're going to be able to maintain that.
Yeah.
You know, cars like that that are so fashionable can go out of fashion very quick.
Exactly. It's a fashion accessory. And people go through fashion accessories, you know. That's why, you know, GM and Ford have done a great job with Mustang, you know, Camaro and Mustang, because the pony cars are almost fashion statements, but there's enough substance there that they keep tweaking them and bringing versions like, you know, Ed's got the ZL1 Camaro coming, and Ford's got the various bosses coming, and you know they're going to bring the bullet back any minute. So, you know, that's a different thing. But this is really, the 500 is a fashion accessory. And once the teenagers, the parents get them for their teenagers in high school, or the parents get them for a fourth car or whatever, that's going to run out pretty quick. Then it's like, okay.
Now what?
Now what? So,
no, you're.
I wish them the best. I like the car, but I don't think it's a.
Well, I think they've got to extend the product line. And they can take a couple of years to do it, but it better not be a whole lot more than a couple of years. Now, I think next year we've got the Abarth coming, which is the high-performance version of it.
Yeah, 160 horsepower, you know, it's kind of nice. But you were saying you saw a stock, bone stock 500, which I get that. I get what you were saying. A bone stock 500 with the dog dish hubcaps and nothing
steel
on
steel wheels.
Steel wheels. Yeah, maybe that's truer to what it should be over here than, you know, see the brake calipers and the alloy wheels and stuff, because that kind of comes apart, you know. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Yep, we will. Well, hey, why don't we take a break right now early, and let's get Ed Welburn in here, because that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Ben, since we're bringing Ed Welburn on, why don't we start off with our friends from Chevrolet? Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over, and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. And it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise. And we got to thank Ed Welburn for joining us here on Out of Line After Hours. Ed, it's great having you back here.
Yeah, Ed is Ed's a cool guy. He's a Chaparral aficionado. He's actually ridden in a Chaparral.
And just in case people don't know, what's a Chaparral?
Oh, you know.
For this show, we shouldn't have to say what.
Yeah, for this show, we shouldn't have to say, but, you know, they were legendary sports racers in the 60s.
The coolest cars. Some of the coolest race cars.
Coolest racing cars of all time.
Leading edge technologically.
Most innovative.
You just never knew from one race to another what they would show up with.
Yeah, and Jim Hall was a visionary.
Yeah, and we're not talking about our Jim Hall.
No. We're talking about the Midland, Texas Jim Hall, who was a visionary and a talented driver in his own right. And he had a technical curiosity that was pretty much his only rival, I would say, was Colin Chapman in that area.
I would agree. And heavily supported by Chevrolet engineering.
Absolutely. Secretly, the whole legend behind it, you know, the secrecy, the innovation.
And the fact that every Chaparral had a duplicate engineering. There was a car, a test vehicle at Chevrolet with an engineering number on it. That, I mean, there was that book.
So anyway, about 3 years ago, Jim Hall took me for a ride in the 2E. Laguna Seca.
At Laguna, got it.
Oh, my God.
Three laps. You know, I was so excited, you know, and I bought a new helmet. I had to get a period helmet, open face, you know, the whole deal. And I get in, slide into the passenger seat. There's no seat belt. And Jim Hall, who reminds me a lot of Clint Eastwood, turned to me and said, I don't think anyone's ever ridden over there before.
Probably not in history.
And, you know, I was so excited. And we took off, and I forgot all about the corkscrew, and we're racing up the hill and swing around and down through the corkscrew. The thing was, open face helmet, the windscreen's lower on the passenger
side. Did you have goggles on?
No. And so down the straightaways, the air was coming towards me faster than I could exhale. I could not breathe on the straightaway.
Oh, yeah.
I had to breathe, take a deep breath on the corners, and then hold my breath down the straightaway. It was great. I said, I just don't want to pass out on this thing. Three laps. Later on, I got to drive it.
Oh, you're kidding.
The lightest, most agile, fun car I've ever driven. I mean, it's unbelievable how simple, how easy that car is to drive.
Yeah, well,
I remember a photo that I thought was at Laguna, it might have been at Riverside, with Jim Hall in one of his Can-Am cars, but instead of all four wheels on the ground, this thing is nose to the ground.
That's in Las Vegas.
Oh, is it in Vegas?
When he had his career driving ending accident. Yeah. Yeah, it was nasty. It was the picture.
One of the scariest pictures.
Yeah, the picture is you see the bottom of the car, the 2G. Yeah, that was really bad.
He still has that car. He never reassembled it. But Jim Hall has kept everything, every one of the cars. You go to the shops, and the cars are there. They're not restored like, you know, Pebble Beach Concourse vehicles. They're all restored like we have a race next weekend.
Yeah, and they run them about once a month.
Well, he donated them to the museum. Well, the museum actually takes care of them.
Wonderful museum.
And he gave them to the museum strictly on the stipulation that once a year they have to be taken out on a track and driven at speed. Yeah. That's the only stipulation.
Petroleum Museum in Midland.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful museum. Everyone should see it. He still has Rattlesnake Raceway. I've driven the track. It is a tough track. People don't know that about me. I've driven Rattlesnake Raceway.
Let's back up, you know, for our viewers and listeners. Ed Welburn, you know, GM has a legacy of some of the finest designers in automotive history. They had Harley Earl, who basically invented the craft, who passed the baton to Bill Mitchell. And it was like General Motors, in terms of design, I don't know what's the equivalent of sports analogy of Jim Brown being handed off to Gale Sayers or something. They led the business. There was a reason GM's heyday was in the 50s, in the 60s, and the early 70s when Harley Earl and then Mitchell took over. And, you know, and when you go to we should do this in a show. We should go to the design staff and do two things. One, see the lobby, where they have busts of the designers, and then go see Ed's office, which is basically untouched from the time when they first built it, which is an amazing period piece. But Ed, I feel Ed is the, you know, there's so many talented designers that came between Ed and Mitchell, but I feel that Ed deserves to be mentioned with Harley Earl and Bill Mitchell, because this business today is a totally different business. It's a global business. You know, I talked to Ed enough to know while I was in Korea last week, and I'm going to Shanghai next week, and, you know, the demands on Ed are such, and he's got tremendous talent. You know, Ed will be the first one to say, hey, I've got a great team. But Ed he's an enthusiast. He's got his own way of getting people to respond and do fabulous work.
There are incredible challenges in the industry today.
Yeah.
But it is so much fun.
Yeah. Just by the way, this guy has too much fun.
Okay, the building was built in the 50s. Harley Earl's office is still in place.
But today, go through a tour. We
have the absolute latest technologies, you know, the virtual reality labs. You've been there. We still have, you know, mechanical assembly where we maintain all the historic concepts.
That's the double secret garage, John, that we need to do a show from.
Yeah.
I'd love to have you come visit mechanical assembly, some of the historic concepts, and the latest.
I remember the last time
you will not go is Studio X.
No, you know, you don't be saying that to me, you know. Here I thought you were going to bring
all we want to do is a TV show there.
Yeah, here I thought you were going to bring the C7 on your little phone and just show John and I for a second before you. But no, I'm not going to take you to Studio X.
You know, we've got all the layers of security, all the studios, the advanced studios, the production studios. But Studio X was something that Bill Mitchell created to do special projects that he did not want involvement from a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
I.e., I'll translate. He didn't want management to know.
I brought back Studio X because there were a couple projects that needed some real quiet time. The Camaro started there. We did some Corvette work in there. We did the presidential limousine in there.
So,
that's very cool.
With Secret Service. So It's a very special place. Very few people know where it is.
Well, if we go there and see Mechanical Assembly, that's cool enough. I mean, yeah, last time we were there, the Corvair, the Monza Spider was there, that show car that I rode with Mitchell in. And Ed oversaw the restoration of my favorite all-time car, the original Stingray, which is still, to me, I don't know.
It's an
amazing car from any angle. You walk up to it, you can't believe the size of it.
It's small.
Yes. And I was hoping you were going to say you were going to restore the Shark, but...
We will. And, you know, our paint shop, to some of those guys, they can't wait to do it, to take on that challenge of taking care of, you know, the gradient.
Go ahead.
Tell the Shinoda story.
Yeah, well, the Shark, you know, Mitchell was deep-sea fishing, and he said, oh, you know, and he was inspired, and they did that paint job. And Ed, you tell...
To catch what? He had a swordfish, wasn't it? Or a marlin or something like that? He wanted the paint job.
The top, when you look at the fish in side view, it's really black at the top, and it gradiates almost
down to
white or
white.
Bluish gray at the bottom. And when you look at the Shark from side view.
It's amazing.
The Mako Shark. It has gills. It's got all the nose. It's got the same kind of point, the whole deal. And when they completed the development of that design and they built the runner and they were painting it.
This is a famous story.
The whole deal was, you know, they had to duplicate the color of that fish. And
hanging in Mitchell's office.
It had been hanging in his office. They brought down the paint shop. They had it mounted on the wall. The guys painted and in the gradation of the tones,
there
you know, to perfection. And Mitchell would come down, and he was not happy. They had not duplicated. They didn't get what was in the paint. Over and over again, they repainted it. And finally, one night, they said, enough was enough. And they repainted the fish. One night around midnight. Next day, Mitchell came in. You guys finally got it. That's it.
That's a classic story. There were so many classic stories of Mitchell, though. But that's the part of the business that people don't get from the outside. That there's a camaraderie in design. It's my most favorite aspect of the business.
I still say it's the most important part of the business.
Absolutely.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, it's... Okay, everyone's got great technologies, great fuel economy, pricing is very competitive.
Quality, manufacturing efficiency, blah, blah, blah. That's not what makes people buy cars.
And everyone, I mean, someone may have a technical advantage for a while, but it isn't for long. So design really is that great differentiator.
It's the ultimate initial product differentiator. And you said it best, Ed, when we've got common technologies. Yeah. You know, if you have an electric car, if it looks like a clown car or it looks like the Converge, what are people going to buy? They're going to buy something that excites them visually. Design is even more important today and will continue to be well into the future because that's the only differentiation you're going to get.
Yeah. And that is the challenge. And, you know, it is such a creative team of people. Very diverse, and having the studios around the world really is a big aid because some of these studios really understand how to develop a small car. That's what they do. Others are experts at trucks or
rear-wheel drive,
or you know, luxury vehicles, and I think it's a real advantage.
Now, a lot of times on certain projects, you'll have studios compete for a design, won't you?
Yeah, you will.
How do you decide when you're going to throw a car out to all of them to work on, and then how do you decide which one you're going to pick?
Yeah, it really depends on the project, and it may be two studios in a competition. Camaro, there were two design teams that competed. And the key is at the end of that they both feel as though they won, and they all feel good about what they were working on. We've done that with several of our projects. Not all of them, but several of them.
You've gotten global input on the C7, right?
It took you only a few minutes to bring up an all-new Corvette. I mean, you know, of course you have to keep Corvette fresh and do new Corvettes over time, you know.
It's like a reward. I mean, if you can't get turned on about... If your designers can't get excited about working on a Corvette, then...
I just, you know, a couple years ago, I decided to throw it out to every designer in General Motors Global Design. China, Korea, India, Australia, Brazil, here in the States, Germany. One of their idea or their thoughts on a new Corvette. It was fascinating. These guys, not just what they did, but how they did it and the hours they put into it. You know, they work all, you know, all evening, all night developing these ideas. It was great. It was fabulous.
Well, that's one of the cool
things.
That's
about all I'm going to say about the new Corvette. Any future.
That was more than I thought you would.
That's got to be one of the toughest things to do, though, is decide which one of these designs do you go with?
Yeah, it is a challenge. I think when we developed the Camaro and we had two teams, one in advanced design and the other in that secret studio. And when the two designs were brought together, that was one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make. I mean, we made the right decision, the car that we've gone forward with and that everyone loves.
It's selling well.
But that other design was pretty cool, too. It was real cool.
Still one of the great press introductions. Yeah. It was at the Detroit show. It was for the Camaro.
That was to see adults with tears in their eyes. They were so.
Well, there were some very historic racing Camaros there. That I mean, you know.
Even had my Camaro because my Camaro had been in the studio with the team as they developed it. But Tom Peters' car. There's some historic Smokey Unix.
The black and gold car, Donahue's, my favorite Camaros to this day were the 68s. But
Roger Penske was there. Yeah. I mean, it was huge.
That was really good. And they ran the cars, loud, open pipes. It was awesome. It was good.
We had a great reveal, and this shows how, man, the world is changing. Here we are in Thailand. At the auto show in Thailand, introducing a show vehicle of a future mid-sized truck. And there's a huge Chevy pickup club in Thailand. And they all were there with pickup trucks from the 30s and the 40s and 50s and 60s, Chevy pickups. They were all right-hand drive.
Wow.
Some were absolutely stock. Some were, hot-rodded up. But they were there as part of the whole thing, big Route 66 influence. It is so exciting to see the passion that people have for the Chevrolet brand around the world. I mean, Thailand of all places.
Hmm. Well, Thailand, of course, is the second biggest pickup market in the world, second only to the United States.
It's the number one midsize pickup market in the world. And, two of pickups.
But I didn't know Chevy went back that far and there'd be right-hand steering versions that go back to the 30s and whatnot there. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was cool.
So how do you take that passion in Corvette and Camaro and with the trucks and get them into your mainstream cars?
It's, I think, and there was a period where Chevrolets were starting to turn into commodities. And I give the Camaro project a lot of credit for changing that. It's like it lit a fire in the brand. And I don't care what studio I go into, it can be the studio down in Brazil or the one in China, the designers will have a die-cast model of a Camaro on their desk. They can be working on a small Mini, or they can be developing a new vehicle for the emerging market. It doesn't matter, but that Camaro has its influence on what they're doing. And there's this whole emotional quality. And now, as a global organization, we've developed a clear identity for Chevrolet that is consistent around the world.
It really is. That's one of the things that's impressed me is that consistency, which never existed before.
Yeah, it never did.
And to the point that, when I look at the new Malibu that you've got coming out, it looks much more like an American design to me, and yet you're going to be using that styling elsewhere in the world, and I'm just surprised to see that it would catch on there.
It's a very international size, but, the Chevrolet brand, its roots are in America, and really around the world, they love that. I mean, it's amazing the excitement they have around Camaro everywhere you go. So when you look at the new Malibu and you look at the rear quarters, the hips, there's a bit of that Camaro influence in it, in the rear quarter of the vehicle and in the tail lamp design. And it's an international size vehicle that will be sold in like 100 countries around the world.
Should we take a break here, Jim?
Yeah, why don't we do that? Ben, time to thank our friends at Hyundai. The sixth generation of the Hyundai Sonata is taking the industry by storm, and no wonder. It offers a fluidic design theme that gives it a strikingly modern, coupe-like exterior design, and yet the interior provides the roominess of a full-size car as measured by the EPA. The Sonata also provides an eco-friendly interior with soy-based foam for the seats. Put it all together with Hyundai's strong reliability and value proposition, and you've got yourself a really compelling package. Check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. Well, we've been talking about Chevrolet. Let's talk about some of the other things that you're working on.
How's that new Riviera coming?
You know, boy, I got to tell you, Buick has got to be one of the fastest growing brands in America. The whole turnaround of the Buick brand is something I'm very excited about. Of course, it's doing very well in China. I think they're selling like 3 Buicks in China to every Buick you sell here, but the brand is really growing.
Well, if it wasn't for China, Buick might have not made it.
Yeah, but it is really turning around, and it's something I'm very excited about. La Crosse is doing well.
The Crosse shows well on the road.
Well, not only that, but we're into, what, year 3 of La Crosse right now?
But it still looks good.
Not only that, Peter, I'd make the point that it's even growing more on me. I like the La Crosse now more than I did when it first came out.
I like it better than when you showed it to us in the Heritage Museum for the first time. You teased it. I like it better now. I agree with you. I mean, it looks, you know, we go to all these shows. You see the cars under the lights. You don't know until they're on the road. And they're coming at you, turning in front of you. It's like the A7. I thought the A7, I didn't think much of it in the show. And then one day, one came right in front of me and turned, sun hit it just right, turned, and then went away from me. And it was just like, oh, I get it. And the same with La Crosse. I think it's...
But what really did it for the Buick brand was, I think if La Crosse was first, it would have been good. But I think bringing the Enclave first... Shockingly different vehicle type. It wasn't a four-door sedan.
You're absolutely right.
Arguably the most luxurious, you know.
And well, not only that, but GM is...
body shape in a crossover,
GM is strong in that whole crossover, you know, which is almost pseudo SUV thing. So to establish the new Buick look there where GM is strong was the right thing to do.
Which is such a big change for the brand.
Yeah.
To do that first and then follow up with La Crosse. Yeah, just keep rolling from there.
And the Regals look good. Yeah. I mean, I haven't driven the high-performance one yet. But
but the Regal, of course, started as an Opel, so I'm not sure. I think it works definitely as a Buick in this country, but I'm not sure that if it had just organically been a Buick, it would look as it does right now.
I think that kind of pushed the organization to do some things that ordinarily they would not have done. So I think Buick has really stretched in a way that they wouldn't have. They're not the normal, you know, four-door sedans. They're very stylish, very sculptural, very international size. I think the relationship that Buick has with Opel, the benefits can be really huge. The scale that Buick has in China, the benefits are large as well. And so there's more to come.
So let's talk about Cadillac. You have the new XTS coming, which last time I was with you, we saw the final production, which I think looks noticeably better than the concept. I mean, you have to see it to get it, but what you did on the C-pillar was a significant improvement. And you have to be excited about that because I actually think that XTS is going to be very well received in the market. I really do. First of all, I think you'll get some core Cadillac buyers to come back. But I think it's got the right substance for Cadillac, you know.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear. You know, CTS has been very good for the brand. And we've expanded the CTS lineup with the coupe and the wagon. But until you have a large vehicle, You know, the brand isn't complete at all. And this is a very contemporary large sedan. You know, great interior space, not excessive in its dimensions. And we were surprised how well it was received when we had it at the Geneva show in Europe. And certainly in China, they're looking forward to that large car.
Let's face it. I mean, I love the CTS. I think the CTS Coupe is one of the most stunning production cars that's come along in years, and it will be, I think, considered that many years into the future. You're driving one tonight, aren't you?
I drive it all the time. I even drove one through the winter, but I mean, I absolutely love the car. I love the statement that it makes for the Cadillac brand.
I love
the way the vehicle happened. You know, it was.
I love the fact you're racing it too. The race car looks awesome.
You know, we raced the car when the car was developed. It was, you know, the team was completing work on the sedan, and one of the designers came to me with an idea. He just said, you know, I got this idea for a coupe. You know, and there's no, the coupe market is not very strong here in the States. At all.
Yeah.
But the thing was, it was so hot, his sketch. And we developed a scale model and then a full-size model. And developed it, you know, really worked this thing out before we sprung it on management. It wasn't something that came out of a marketing initiative or product planning or anything. I have all the respect in the world for what they do, but this didn't come out of that. It was just this one designer with a hot sketch. And I like to have an environment in which people feel free to bring me your ideas. Let's try these things. And that's how it grew.
You sprung the concept at the Detroit show. You know, to me, it harkens back to the heyday of GM in that Mitchell's, I think, brilliance was bringing concept car look and feel to mainstream America. That CTS Coupe looks like a concept car on the street, whether it's the regular one or the V. It just has that look. And that's what Mitchell was brilliant at, in my estimation. He brought some this concept car look to the mainstream.
I was very confident that the V version would look great on the street. But even the base coupe seems right, you know. It's got an exaggerated proportion, and there are things about it that may violate the norms, the visibility and things, but the car is strong.
It's nice to see a point of view.
Well, what you're saying here, Ed, is you and one designer worked out this concept, because it goes back to what we were saying earlier of design is king. Design is what makes people stop and stare and say, oh my God, I've got to have that. Mm-hmm. None of the other stuff does it. It's design that does it. And you don't get great design out of committees. You don't get great design out of clinics and market research. You get great design out of vision. Yeah. And I love hearing that you will allow your people to bring vision to you and then try to work on bringing it to production.
You've got to have that kind of culture in which people feel free to come forward with their ideas. That's how that vehicle happened. And a leadership that, you know, really welcomed the idea. I mean, you know, it was well thought out, and they recognized, you know, the value in it. It's, you know, there are some design organizations, not just in the auto industry, but throughout industry, in which design is kind of a service, and others where they're true partners. And I feel as though at GM, design is a partner. I'm on Dan Akerson's executive team. You know, the executive committee, there are meetings that I'm in that the focus isn't really, it's not a design review, but design can have an influence. And we're now at a point in GM design where we're having an influence on the aesthetics of everything in the company. See, auto show displays.
I'm telling you, that's good to hear. And shareholders should hear this too. And I'll tell you why, because when you have management that's just financially running the company or just looking at the numbers, all it does is capture cost. That's why they call it cost accounting. All it does is capture cost. It does nothing at capturing value. And something like a CTS Coupe can absolutely transform the public's opinion about what Cadillac stands for and make it aspirational. And no amount of spreadsheets are ever going to get you to that solution.
And every brand really needs that kind of iconic vehicle, that kind of statement. Yeah, absolutely.
So talk a little bit about the ATS, too, the small car that you've got coming.
Oh, I can't really say anything.
Well, come on. You've showed us that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I've seen it. You and I talk about it.
You guys talk about it, and I'll listen. You know, tell me about it.
Well, you know, the Cadillac strategy, the CTS is going to get a little bigger, so it's more like the 5 Series. You've got the XTS, which is, you know, a little bigger than that.
And fascinating concept.
Yeah, and the ATS comes right in at the 3 Series. Funny how that works. But I
thought it was a little bit smaller than the 3.
Yeah, it is a little smaller, but it looks, to all the people out there, it looks good. It looks like Cadillac.
Nice try.
Well, then talk about it this way. This has got to help Cadillac outside of the U.S. market. The brand has got to have a smaller car that sells in volume.
Absolutely. I mean, Cadillac is, you know, they've had their challenges in China, but with the new products, it's really starting to catch on. I mean,
sales were up 88% last month. I remember that figure.
The SRX is a huge hit in China.
Well, China, they just love these crossovers, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, the last auto show, that Shanghai show, you know, from my hotel room, I'm watching the trucks take the vehicles into the show, and I guess they had some large lot where they dropped off all the vehicles for the show, and then these flatbeds took them in, and it was just SUV, SUV.
Well, look at what Audi's doing with their Q5 in China. Yeah, it's just... Yeah.
But the SRX is really, really doing well.
And that's another good-looking vehicle. You know, we talked about, like, the LaCrosse and whatnot, but and the CTS Coupe. I like the SRX a lot. I like it from all angles, in fact.
It's doing very well, thank you.
So what else can you talk about that we can talk about?
Well, look, let's take another break here, and then we got to get to a bunch of questions from the audience. But, Ben, let's thank our friends at Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Okay, it's time for a rapid fire. Ben, let's bring it in. Boy, so many questions here. Let's just jump right into them. Field says, any chance for a Buick Regal version of the Insignia Sport Tourer?
Oh, there's a lot of interest in that. In fact, there are a few of them running around Detroit right now. there's so many cars we're bringing to production. I mean, this has got to be the busiest time in the history of the company. Our studios globally are running flat out.
And think about it. You got rid of 4 brands.
Yeah.
And you're still running flat out.
We're running flat out.
Okay, Baja Busta says, was the CTS Coupe designed in Studio X?
No. The CTS Coupe was done right in the Cadillac studio. Bob Munson was the guy who did the original sketch. I mean, I'll never forget that sketch. Scale models were developed quickly. It's a full-size model. We showed it to the leadership of the company, and there you go.
Here's a good question from Mitch.
Then he followed it up with a wagon. Go ahead.
Mitch wants to know, are there elements in a design that are especially difficult to get right? And he asks, why does a car look different when it's moving compared to standing still?
Yeah, you know, it's every time in the development of a vehicle, at each step, it's like I'm seeing it for the first time. You know, the first time you see that hot sketch, you get excited, and then when you see it in scale model form and then the full-size model on the patio, and you want to take it outside and have it revolving, you know, on the turntables. But then when you see it on the street, it's like you're seeing it again for the first time.
Just like Peter was talking about.
So exciting.
But are there certain elements of the car that are especially hard to get right?
Well, it's difficult if the proportions aren't right. If it's not in the architecture, if you don't have the enablers to get the relationships of wheelbase to track to body to overhangs, if that's not right, then it's extremely difficult. So that really requires... It requires a strong vision for what you want in the design up front, and then great collaboration with engineers. I mean, you know, engineers and designers, there's always some friction, but when you have that collaboration, then you can get the architecture right, you get the elements right, and it's much easier than to style the vehicle.
We've got a lot of phone calls coming in. Ben, let's get to the first one.
My question is for Ed Wilburn. Could you possibly give us an abstract description of what you see the C7 being and how it differentiates itself from the C6. I'm a three-time owner of Corvettes, two C5s, a Z06, and now a C6 coupe, and I love it, and I'm anticipating the C7 release.
That's Jonathan.
And any information that you could give us, I understand it has to be in total abstract terms, but if you could... Is it going to be, you know, smaller, lighter?
I can't do that. I can't
tell you. I'll answer that for John.
But I got to tell you, I am so excited about what we're developing. I really am.
I'll answer that.
And it's a huge challenge to do. Everybody wants to design a Corvette. And then once you get into it, boy, it is not easy. But the relationship between design and engineering on this one, we all realize it's time for significant changes, and yet you got to hold on to some elements that make a Corvette a Corvette. I mean, there's a crowded market out there, and it needs to, the essence of what makes a Corvette's got to stay true, but we also need to appeal to, I think, a younger market.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, what's your answer?
The C7 is kind of a transition car. But it will be, design-wise, it'll be pretty cool. Very cool. Slightly smaller, but we're not talking very much smaller. Lighter. And the detailing, the interior, the cockpit, everything else will be very contemporary.
So the audience knows. He's trying to bait me.
No, I'm not.
Debating whether or not it's going to be like that or something
no,
else.
No, I don't. Yeah. I don't want. You don't need to say anything.
Nice try.
You don't need to say anything. But that's pretty much what we're talking. Now, C8, that's a whole other thing.
And Ed didn't say anything about that. DC Auto Geek wants to know, in your opinion, Ed, what drives people to buy one truck over another? Powertrain or design?
I think reputation is a huge part of why someone buys one truck over another. There's an emotional connection that's there as well. You know, are they really turned on by its scale and its muscles and all of that? Is it, you know, but reputation... Durability.
Well, don't you think truck buyers are the most partisan, loyal?
Well, they are.
I mean,
they are.
You've seen the bumper stickers.
Yeah,
I'd rather push a Chevy than drive a Ford.
Yeah, they are so loyal. I mean, the loyalty there. That group, and there's one other group, and that would be like where the 3 Series BMW is and that whole category of small luxury vehicles. Very loyal there. I mean, they don't, BMW got to have a, doesn't that? Anything to do with the Mercedes and vice versa. But that truck group is so loyal and so strong. Yeah.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hi, everyone. Great show. This is Joe from Austin, Texas. I have a question for Ed Wilburn. If you could tell us some details or some insight about what the next Camaro is going to be as far as its design influence or what the design, exterior design, going to be like, what they're looking at. But the Mustang, they're saying the Mustang is going to be revolutionary. The next Mustang is going to be revolutionary. What the Camaro is going to do from then on? Just like to hear that feedback. Thanks. Great show. Bye.
You know, the important thing with Camaro is, you know, this car has just connected with customers across America and really around the world. I mean, it is such an iconic vehicle and does so much for the brand, and you just don't want to upset that. The challenge is, you know, you want to retain what that is that connects with everyone, and yet you do need to progress. You know, I've watched vehicles that they were timid, they were afraid to change, and then they lost.
Yeah. And
then they lost.
We can verify that the next Camaro is on a different platform and slightly smaller and lighter.
What are you talking about?
Ed doesn't even know about
what
that.
Are you is that right? You know? but the key is right now, with the car that we've got, you know, you continue to keep it fresh. You continue to move it. There are new additions that happen. Yeah, we had this competition, which I think is great, between Camaro and Mustang.
Yeah,
I love that competition.
The business needs that.
But you don't want to lose sight of that base vehicle and keeping it fresh as well. And so that is important. I don't know if I successfully dodged this question about next generation, because I can't talk about the next generation.
That's okay. That's why Peter's
car,
here.
But boy, I mean, there is a soul that's within Camaro that is so important
that we retain. It's funny, historically, you know, the Mustang came out when it debuted. I mean, hundreds of thousands of them sold. And then everyone's waiting for Chevy's answer. And then the Camaro came out, and it was just like, wow, that's very cool. And then the Mustang, you know, back and forth. Now you have the upper hand, the Camaro. Now it's in Ford's court because they're working on their next generation Mustang. It's great. It's part of the business, and I'm glad it's still going on.
Yeah.
No question. Another question from Bob McElroy. Maybe he pronounces it McElroy. He's not any relationship to me, but he's got a good question, and I'll have to pare it down here. And others have asked this, too. How about some great interiors that are not black? And there's another question in here, you know, or beige or gray. That we seem to only get three colors these days from anybody.
It's, you know, there was a point just a few years ago where I think GM was 2 years behind the industry when it comes to interior design.
Two?
And we had to really, okay, maybe three or four.
Okay.
But was important. We put together
that.
A very, very talented team, brought in some new people in it as well, put incredible focus on it. Bob Lutz is a big part of that, on interior design, and have really turned that around. Color, both interior and exterior, is very much influenced by the economy. And when the economy is tough, people make conservative choices because they're thinking 3 years now, am I going to be able to sell this car with that strikingly different interior color or exterior color or not? And during this period of time, most of our customers aren't willing to make that kind of risk. I do see some areas where it's starting to change, though. And, you know, the CTS that I'm driving, that CTS-V, I mean, okay, it's got all black interior, but it's got that insert that is got, you know, the splash of color in the interior, and then the contrasting stitching that really adds a lot of energy to the interior design, something we would not have done a couple years ago. I think you'll start to see more color in the interior. But it's a challenge.
Well, I still see another thing. I think manufacturing's got too much say in these things these days. And I understand you need to have manufacturing efficiency. But to me, they want to limit build variation as much as possible. They'd rather build every car the same if they could.
I think we found we were able to unlock that code with a new vehicle that you'll see from Cadillac very soon. And you'll start to see a lot more choices in the interior.
We didn't even talk about the Uber Cadillac.
No, we didn't.
The Prestige sedan for $135,000.
Does Peter have to tell you about that car too?
It doesn't exist. Forget I even said it.
Let's bring in another phone call here. We got a bunch of them.
Another phone call.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York, and I have two questions for Ed. One is I would be interested in knowing what classic cars he has in his personal collection. Second, I would be interested in his opinion if we will ever see a Riviera or a Riviera-type vehicle offered by GM again. When I say a Riviera-type vehicle, I mean a big, beautiful two-door luxury sedan that can comfortably sit four people. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, it's, you know, Rivieras. I mean, I love Rivieras. That's, you know, when I turned 16, my father had a Riviera 65 Riviera.
Oh, boy, that was a stunning car.
And I loved that car. I got so many tickets driving that car. I mean, but I loved it. You know, this personal luxury car with that great console. And you know,
isn't
it sounds
that,
bizarre.
That gear shift?
Yeah, it sounds bizarre that you could blend a Rolls-Royce with a Ferrari and get a great design. But Bill Mitchell did it with that car.
And his personal Riviera that he drove, the Silver Arrow, was stunning. I mean, he chopped the roof even further. And
but the idea of a personal luxury car like that, I think, is a very valid concept today.
Ding, 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 ding,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ding.
Whether it's a two-door or a four-door coupe, you know, it. You know, there is room for it.
I mean, yeah.
We have a lot of vehicles, as I said earlier, that we're doing, very important vehicles. I would love to do a Riviera.
Yeah,
there
I know
are many of us who would love to do a Riviera.
Shed some light
we'll
on.
Do that? I don't know, but okay.
Shed some light on some of your cars. You have a.
I have a my '69 Camaro, which, you know, we talked about.
It's really nice.
And
you brought it to the Dream Cruise.
To the Dream Cruise 2 years ago, right?
I drive it to work every now and then. You know, I commute to work in it. It's an almost perfect car that, after a couple years of driving this absolutely stock car, I decided, you know, it would be a lot more fun if the suspension was enhanced a bit, if the wheels were a little bigger, nothing big and crazy. So I designed a set of five-spoke wheels, a little larger than stock, and had them made on the West Coast. And just a few little adjustments here and there to make it a lot more fun to drive. So there's that, and I've got a Corvette, just a few years old, that is a convertible, top never goes up on. It's just a fun car to run around town in. And my daily driver is a CTS-V coupe.
Fantastic.
My wife has a CTS wagon, so, yeah.
That's great. Let's
you
get back.
To come by the garage sometime.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do that. On our way to the X studio. Okay, Mike Dwight says, are you still working on the Bare Necessities concept car I read about a couple of years ago?
The Bare Necessities concept?
I don't know what that is, unless it's a little pod car that they did in
Shanghai. I'll tell you, the big thing is that the emerging markets are growing fast. And it used to be that that is where old cars kind of went, you know, after they left the market in the established market, you know, like a 10-year-old vehicle would then be sold in the emerging markets. But customers in emerging markets want the latest design. Even, you know, even if it's going to be an extremely affordable vehicle. We have a studio in Brazil that is really focused on the emerging market. And vehicles like, you know, the Colorado show truck that we showed for Chevrolet. And there's a new Cobalt, which was designed for the emerging market, a sedan. And there are other vehicles that we're developing. I mean, it is an important market. It's changing rapidly. All the competition is starting to move there with new, fresh product. So we have a real focused effort around designing very fresh new designs for the emerging market.
Yeah, that's where the growth is.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
for sure.
Tremendous growth.
Hey, let's bring in another phone call here, Ben.
Yeah, John, Rick from San Diego. I wonder if Ed could tell us anything about a possibility of the Buick Riviera coming back.
And we already got that. Yeah.
Another vote for Riviera.
Yeah. You know? Well, we've talked about that one. Goggles Pisano says, you've reimagined the Camaro. What GM vehicle from the past would you love to revive next?
Other than the Riviera?
Other than the Riviera. Right.
Yeah, Riviera would really be one of those vehicles.
Well, plus the market is welcoming, like you said, and may not necessarily be a two-door coupe. It could be the four-door coupe to go against the...
A modern interpretation of that personal luxury vehicle is what I think we're talking
which
about.
Which would go wonderfully against the A7 and the CLS Mercedes, because I know if they'd execute it.
Yeah, but
right.
we certainly, I mean, it's a car that I'm very interested in, but... I mean, there's so many other products that we're working on right now that we'd have to wait for that one for a little bit.
Can't do them all. Can't do them tomorrow either.
Although I want to, you know.
Well, everybody does.
Yeah.
Joseph says, I hear some complaints about how the high belt lines have gotten or how high the belt lines have gotten. Yeah. Camaro being just one example. How long will this high belt line be the style?
I think it really depends on the category. I don't think there's not a formula for design. There is no one form vocabulary or proportion that works for everything. You know, Camaro's got a high belt, and
price
will
$300.
Continue to have a high belt. It's that whole proportion, that relationship of the upper to the lower that is very important. If we drop the belt on the Camaro, it would
look goofy.
It would turn it into this two-door sedan.
Yeah.
And no one would be.
I totally agree. Yeah. And sort of along these lines, Wright Knight wants to know, could you see the return of the tail fin at Cadillac? And you kind of have a little bit in the SRX tail
lights. Yeah, it's back. You look at the SRX, there's the Hinnebeck fin.
CTS Coupe.
CTS Coupe. You know, just the fact that we have vertical tail lamps, that is all a link to the fin. We'll never bring them back. I don't think we'll ever bring them back.
Well, not like to the degree,
fins, you know,
not like the 59, right?
59 or 60, but there's a hint of a fin on every Cadillac that we develop.
Well, you know, when you look at the Le Mans cars this year that Audi and Peugeot had, they had fins going down the middle of the car.
That was required by the FIA.
That's required, but what I'm getting at is, as I think cars get to be more aerodynamic again, there are certain things that you could use that would be legitimate.
At the tail of a vehicle, a strong vertical line at the corner really helps from an aero perspective. Call it a fin, just call it a good trip strip or whatever at the tail of the car, but it really helps. I mean, Volt has a strong vertical line that really helps it from an aero perspective.
You want that crisp separation budget. Point.
Yeah. Well, those Le Mans prototypes also had vertical LED lights in the back. Did you see?
Which you could see at night. Yeah, that was awful.
Cool. Awesome. Le Mans cars are really cool. I've always had this love for the cars that run at Le Mans, the endurance cars.
Well, don't forget, for your viewers out there and listeners, Ed was the principal guy behind the Aerotech, which was a stunning car, which could have easily sat on the grid at Le Mans.
I think it was my love of cars that run at Le Mans, the 917s in particular, the long tail, that were my inspiration. And you know, the very first sketch I did on that project was really the sketch that was used. I finally got a chance to drive that car.
The Aerotech?
The Aerotech?
A few months ago. And
didn't A.J. Foyt set some speed record with that thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he did. I got to know him quite well through that project.
What's that, 252 miles an hour?
257, and closed course record. And others have tried to break that record and weren't able to do it. And
no
just
kidding.
Quietly, they tried to keep that very quiet.
In fact, Oldsmobile used that in an ad that I seem to remember where there was like some sort of fog or dust, and this car just burst out of it, and it was such a cool shot.
I mean, it was a 2-liter engine with 1,000 horsepower. Not necessarily an endurance engine.
But I love it.
It was great. It was a great project. I learned a lot about working in aero. It was kind of a transition project for me from just being a designer on the boards to one who was still sketching but managing a project, working with marketing, working with the aero guys, working with this Texan named A.J. Foyt. He and I actually got along quite well, and he gave me this pair of great ostrich skin boots, Tane Lama boots, when he set the record. And those records still stand. And I finally got to drive the car last year.
Wow.
It was cool.
That was based on a March IndyCar chassis, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a March IndyCar chassis. Actually, a cheated version of it because we reduced the fuel tanks and things like that, and it sat a bit lower. Man, a cockpit was so tight, and you don't move at all when you're in there. And it was great to drive the car because all the things that I was hearing from AJ about the latches and with the canopy and all that and certain things that were happening, I finally said, yeah, I understand. After all these years, I understand why there are things he liked and things that he complained about. Huh. I didn't drive it at nearly the speed that he's at. I mean, the guys at the Proving Grounds thought that I was going to try to go out and run a bet 250, 260. And so they put some Corvettes ahead of me and it strategically placed them so that I couldn't pass them, you know. So they were kind of my governor. But it was a
lot. We're at Milford?
Yeah.
On the 5-mile circle?
Yeah.
Hey, let's bring in another phone call here, Ben.
Hi, it's Ralph from Toronto, Canada. Just wanted to know if Mr. Welburn could tell us if there's any chance or opportunities to maybe get the Utes from Australia up here. I know they work quite well down in Australia for the commercial market. So is there any chance that that product could be maybe marketed in North America? Thank you.
Yeah, we've looked at that a number of times. You know, I mean, basically it's an El Camino. Is what it is.
Well, you had the Pontiac. We showed that at New York.
Yeah, we've looked at it real hard. We looked at it as a Pontiac. We've looked at it with a couple other brands. I mean, if you were to do it, it would have to be a Chevrolet, a Chevy El Camino. And with so many great products under development for Chevrolet or in the market today or under development, it doesn't have quite the priority, I got to say. And it still has, I mean, it even came up today as something, you know, people are interested in doing in the company, but it is not in the plans right now.
How about, since we're talking about some of the stuff out of Australia, front drive versus rear drive? Mm. You know, the industry seems to be on this binge again to go back to, or go 100% front drive again.
Yeah, really. I mean, for so many efficiencies and fuel economy and all that, more efficient vehicles. But there is still room for rear drive vehicles, and there's certainly rear drive vehicles in our future.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah is right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been so much a part of the Holden brand. Now, Toyota has gone into Australia with front drive vehicles and have done quite well. I think
number one in the market?
Yeah, so we, you know, the Holden brand is a very important brand.
Uh-huh.
And we have to do the absolute right thing for that brand for them to be successful. And so I think you'll see a good variety of vehicles. Now, you know, they've got the Cruze there as a Holden. It's, you know, a front drive vehicle. And there's some very special versions of it that will be there. You know, in Australia, they do some really hot stuff.
That's right. Phil Hopewell in Burlington, Ontario wants to know, how do I pare this down a bit? How do you decide whether a car should be an angular design or a rounded design?
Yeah, well, I think you really, number one, in a market as crowded as ours is, a brand has to stand for something. A brand has to have a very strong identity, the brand character. And we have established a look, a form vocabulary for each one of our brands. It will evolve over time, but, you know, don't look for a very rounded Cadillac in your future. I mean, that very angular art and science form vocabulary for Cadillac will continue. The hard edges on the fenders. Now, it will become a bit more sophisticated. That form between those creases will become a bit more sophisticated. But I think it is important for Cadillac to retain that art and science form vocabulary, not to, you know, step into the same area where other luxury brands would be. Customers are looking for distinction, and we'll keep it. And that's true for every one of our brands. We have worked hard to establish a very clear identity for Chevrolet globally. Before we were a global design organization, all over the world, Chevrolets were different things, you know, different markets. Now we have a very clear identity for the brand. Buick has a very strong, very fluid, romantic form vocabulary for it. GMC has got a very strong identity. You know, it's just industrial precision. And with a market as crowded as ours is, you have to have an identity that really stands out. And you do have to be sensitive. I mean, just you need to evolve that look over time, but not just jump from one to another.
Okay, let's bring in another phone call here.
Yes, my name is Clem Zarovsky. I'm from Delmont, Pennsylvania. I'd like to ask Mr. Welborn, why does GM insist on making all their cars look like four-wheel drive trucks? Even my 2008 Corvette has 2 or 3 inches of gap between the top of the tires and the curve on the fenders. If you look at foreign cars, Mercedes and such, their cars, the body sets down over the top of the tires for a better-looking stance. I'd like to hear his opinion on that. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, there are two ways of dealing. I mean, your tire is going to move. There's the whole movement of the tire, the suspension in a vehicle within the body shape. And there are two ways of dealing with that. You either have a taller wheel opening and you can get the tire out flush to the body and the tire will move within that envelope. Or you can move the tire in or the body out and bring it down lower and you can get the move. We cannot have interference between the tire and the sheet metal. So there are two ways of looking at it. You can make the body wide with a narrow track and get it down low, or you can keep the body in trim or a great relationship. I prefer having a great tire-to-body relationship that is flush. It does mean it. Somewhat taller wheel opening, but it's a much leaner, more agile look for a vehicle. We had cars that had low wheel openings, but they were very heavy, ponderous vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that those brands are heavy and ponderous, but that's not the way we're going to develop our designs.
I think we got time for a couple of more here. Let's bring the next one in, Ben.
Hi, John. This is Oz Rutherford from Greenville, South Carolina. I just wanted to point a few things out about who's number one in the world. If when you go to GM China, you can include SAIC GM because they now own 50% of it. But the real kicker is now GM is Pakistan, which GM has been bragging about as their golden egg now. GM only owns 25% of that company, of that organization. The other 75% belongs to the government, and that includes a majority of their sales from Russia and Eastern Europe. So you take those out, Volkswagen could already be number one in the world. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, what's next?
Yeah.
You want to take that one? I mean, you were so eager to talk about
it. You know, that wasn't a question. That was just like...
He raises a point, but I think what he's referring to is some data houses argue that GM should not count the sales at Wuling in China because it's a minority owner in that. Mm. But, yeah, how many angels dance on the head of the pin? Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Hi, this is Bridge in Port Washington, Wisconsin. Ed, you're a hero. If GM survives, you'll go down in history with Harley Earl and Bill Mitchell. I was just wondering if there's ever going to be a high-volume two-door. I know it would have to be front-wheel drive. I think it might be a necessity with CAFE standards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do really appreciate that compliments for something that I really enjoy doing. A volume two-door vehicle, there are a number of ways of looking at that, and we are certainly studying that right now and really looking at, in a very different way, what young people are looking for in a vehicle. And the fruits of some of those studies, I think you will see in the not-too-distant future. But yeah, it is so fascinating just trying to get into the heads of what young people are looking at. On the most part, they're really looking for sedans, and which is a surprise to a lot of people who are older than them. But young people travel in packs.
Yeah,
whether it's
exactly,
you know,
right.
You know, young girls, they have all their girlfriends with them, and guys, they got their boys with them wherever they're going. And so a four-door or a five-door really meets their needs much better than a two-door. And it's usually someone older than them that thinks young people want a little two-door coupe. Well, no.
Now, that's true in the U.S. market. Is it true outside of here, too?
Very much so. And in some markets, the two-door is really considered. It's cheaper if you only have two doors instead of four. But in so many markets, you know, you've got, you know, quite a few people to ride with. This, and so the two-door market is not that huge. When you look at the desire for a Camaro, it's, you know, it's a two-door, and it does quite well globally. It's still not a super high-volume vehicle. We continue to look at it, and we have some very, very fascinating studies going on now. But on the most part, I'd say, you know, customers would rather have a four-door or a five-door. I mean, even with trucks, they prefer more than two doors.
That's right. Well, look, this is probably as good a time as any to wrap it up. But Ed Welborn, thanks for stopping by for Autoline After Hours. This is awesome.
Well, I enjoyed
this is really
time
good.
With you guys.
Yeah, no, this is really good. And anytime you want to learn what's going on in the company, you just come here and Peter will fill you in. And Peter, always great having you here, of course.
Great to be here, John.
And then we got to remind everybody, next week we're down at the Dream Cruise. And we'll be webcasting live Thursday night, so it's not the official Dream Cruise. But it should be a pretty awesome time down on Woodward next week. And, of course, I should remind everybody that you can always friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. Check out Peter's stuff at AutoExtremist.com or follow him at twitter.com/AutoExtremist or facebook.com/AutoExtremist. Tomorrow night, we've got Open Line, the podcast going up, Roundabout. Excuse me. In fact, Christian Conover from Roundel Table, which is the BMW podcast, he's going to be the guest host for Roundabout tomorrow night. And we're still working on improving our website here, and we'd love to have a few more people check out our links. If you're behind a corporate firewall, drop us an email. We'd love to use you as a guinea pig. Send it to viewermail@outoflinedetroit.tv, and we've got some experimentation that we're doing with our website, and we'd like to make sure it gets through the firewalls. Don't forget, too, you can always get our shows via Stitcher on your BlackBerry or smartphone, and you can win $100. Just go to stitcher.com/outofline, enter the promo code OutOfLine, and you can get the app at the iTunes or Android stores. And thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.